Grant Merritt has served as executive director of the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, was a member of the first board of the Minnesota Environmental Quality Control Council, and was Minnesota's representative on the Great Lakes Water Quality Board. He's also served on the Parks and Trails Council of Minnesota. Grant was an attorney in the areas of environmental law, transportation, and governmental relations for more than 50 years. His recent book, Iron and Water, is a memoir of his life's work on behalf of Minnesota's people and the environment, and also the story of a significant family in our state's history. He joins us now on the phone from Duluth. Welcome to the Roadhouse, Grant Merritt.
Yes, hello.
Well, Grant, a true privilege and an honor to be speaking with you, sir. Thanks for making time for us.
Thank you.
You're a legend. And you were just in town. How was everything at the library this past week?
Oh, I like that library. I like your director, Steve Harson, and we had about 40 people there asking questions and listening.
Wonderful.
Signing books.
Well, Grant, you've been an environmental lawyer and an advocate for the environment your whole life, and you come from a family with a very unique history in our area. Tell our listeners about your family and mining on the Iron Range.
My family arrived at the head of the lakes in 1855 and 1856, and they shortly went into business. The boys traded up and down the South Shore and the North Shore of Lake Superior. They built the first commercial vessel in Duluth, 70 feet long and 70 ton, the Chaska. And then a couple of years after they were in business with the Chaska, they got shipwrecked over at Onondaga, where they were hauling big boulders for the breakwater. And the only thing they could save was the rigging, which meant they were in debt about $3,500 back in 1872. And so the next winter, they went out, cut pine, and paid off their debts. And they said that might have been the best thing that happened to them, established the credit. So then they cut pine and was able to raise enough capital to search for iron ore. And the reason they searched for iron ore was partly because their father, my great-grandfather, Lewis Howell Merritt, was from New York and came to the head of the lakes to build the first sawmill, went up to the Lake Vermilion so-called gold boom in 1866. He came back, said, well, I wasn't boomed with the gold. That's never going to amount to much. But he said, I think someday there will be big iron ore mines up there that will dwarf the profits from gold in California. And the reason he said that is that there was an Indian, Albert North Posey, up there at what became Mesaba, the height of the land, gave them a chunk of iron ore, hard rock. And they had that assayed in Duluth. And it was about 65% iron ore. So they decided maybe this isn't the iron ore that's there because it probably came in with a glacier. But they decided to do test pitting. So from 1887 to 1890, they sunk holes, shoveled test pits, used a diamond drill some of the time. And finally, on November 16, 1890, they discovered the first iron ore body of ore up there at Mount Iron. And what it was a horizontal lens of red dirt. And they had experts come up there right away to look at it. The experts all said, well, this can't be iron ore. Are you going to have a shaft? You can't have a wall. And there's no way you can mine that. And they said, no, we're not going to have a underground mine. We're going to farm this iron ore. In other words, we're going to use a steam shovel. And that's what they did. And then they immediately looked for one of the railroads that were nearby to build over to Mountain Iron. And they couldn't find a single one of the railroad companies were interested, so they said, well, we'll build our own railroad. So they built the Duluth, Mesaba, and Northern, which and the Duluth, Mesaba, and Iron Range Railroad since they merged with the IR out of Two Harbors. And then they had to build in Duluth because the contract with the Duluth and Winnipeg didn't come through. And so they had to build another 26 miles from Brookston to Duluth, and then an ore dock. They built the world, at that time, the world's largest iron ore dock in Duluth, right where the current docks are located. And then in July 22nd, 1893, they were able to ship iron ore out of that dock. The first shipment went to the Alloys dock on the Duluth and Winnipeg, but after the D&W reneged on the contract they had, they then built it in Duluth. So that's the history in a hurry, but the problem after that was that the second largest depression in our country's history hit in 1893, about the time they were finishing that dock, which, by the way, they built in 5 months. I don't know how they did that. They had 1,000 men out there working on that dock. Anyhow, that hit, and then they looked for more capital. They tried to get Jim Hill to go into business with them, and he almost did, but he was concerned that the Congress was going to repeal the tariff against ore coming in from Europe, and then he would have trouble competing, so he wouldn't loan them any money or take any stock. So then they ended up with John D. Rockefeller, the country's greatest Rob Marion. He swindled them or defrauded them, and the way he did that was he squeezed them, loaned them money, and then wouldn't pay what he was supposed to, and then he insisted on going into business with the Merritts. He told them, you put all your mines in. By this time, they had 7 mines. And then I'll put in my mines. I own 3 mines. And everybody write down what the mines are worth, and then we'll go into business. The only problem is Rockefeller's mines, 2 in Michigan, upper Michigan, and 1 in Cuban, turned out to be worthless or next to worthless. And that was proven later in the lawsuit after Rockefeller then he called the loan that he had out to the Merritts, and he, in one fell swoop, he took over all of the Merritt properties and holdings. And my grandfather, Alfred Merritt, sued him for fraud. And that was in federal court here in Duluth, and proved that there was fraud because Rockefeller put these mines of his into the Lake Superior Consolidated Company at fictitious values. So Rockefeller was trying to build a monopoly. He didn't like competition. And that's what happened. But my grandfather, after he won the lawsuit, Rockefeller always bragged that he never lost in the court's appeal. They went to St. Louis and they got the case reversed and remanded. And then the Merritts settled because they couldn't afford another trial. And after that, my grandfather sued Rockefeller for the swindling. That's what the Minneapolis Star Tribune called it in the book review of my book. And proved that. And then once they settled, Rockefeller wouldn't pay for 3 months. And the historians have not written this up properly, so that's one reason I wrote the first part of my book, the part about iron, to set the record straight and correct some wrongs that were happening back then.
Yeah, Grant, no doubt that's been a theme of your entire career, and, you know, setting things straight, correcting wrongs. Nothing's more famous than your battle to stop the Reserve Mining Company, what was then the Reserve Mining Company, from dumping taconite tailings into Lake Superior down at Silver Bay. You know, of course, a big section in your book dedicated to those times. What stands out for you the most from that time? You know, for me, it's the volume. I look at 67,000 tons per day.
That's right.
And is this true, like a train car a minute?
Well, I think that is right. And they also had oily rags in those laundry chutes going into Lake Superior, and calcium chloride that they used to thaw the big chunks of taconite coming down from Babbitt during the winter, and also fly ash and other toxic chemicals. So they put everything in the chutes. These chutes were, two of them were 26 feet wide each, and that's where they dumped from 1956 until 1980, when they finally went on land, which is what we set out to have them do from the very beginning. And I first learned about the problems with their dumping from Milton Matson. My uncle at East Beaver Bay had the Matson store, and his brother worked out there on the project when they were building the Silver Bay plant in Silver Bay, and he told his brother Milton about what was going on. So Milton came down to Minneapolis, told me about it, and I thought, this can't be. We got to do something about it. We got to get into the courts. We got to get into politics, and economics need to be studied. So that's what we did starting in 1967. But I wasn't the only one that got involved. There was a woman out of Michigan, Verna Mai. She started her activity writing letters 3 months before I did, in August of 1967. And we then shortly, thanks to Milton Matson, formed the Save Lake Superior Association. And he recruited Arlene Lato to be president, and the Save Lake Superior Association still survives 40 years later to today. And then, of course, there were other groups like Minnesota Environmental Control Citizens Association, which I was involved in down in Duluth. And we stirred the pot. And finally, before Stuart Udall left as Secretary of Interior at the very end of the Democratic hold on government in Washington. So early in 1969, before Nixon was sworn in, he called a conference called the Lake Superior Enforcement Conference. And that enabled the public to testify, and boy, that really blew the lid off of reserve. The first hearing was in the Hotel Duluth ballroom up on the sixth floor. There were 600 people there. About two-thirds of them were citizens that were trying to fight reserve. The other third were from Silver Bay, supporting the company. And the company was hoodwinking people, saying there's no problem, that green water off of Silver Bay going down towards Duluth, it's a natural phenomenon, and all kinds of baloney like that. We had to expose those falsehoods. And that went on then for 3 years. And finally, under the same law that set up this enforcement conference, the EPA administrator, Bill Ruckelshaus, was able to get the Nixon administration to agree that he could start a lawsuit in federal court against reserve mining. And that resulted in a trial before Judge Lord from 1973 to 74, 9 month trial. And finally, Judge Lord ordered the company to shut down until they agreed to go on land. And then, of course, the Eighth Circuit, the same court that my grandfather had to deal with back in the 1890s. They reversed Judge Lord, and that went on for a while. Finally, though, the Eighth Circuit agreed with Lord that the company had to go on land. And another judge, Judge Devitt, said in 1976 to the state and reserve, if you don't pick a site for an on-land disposal location, I'm going to reimpose Judge Lord's temporary injunction to shut the plant down. And so they finally got together, and then Milepost 7 was built. But that took another 3 years, so it wasn't until 1980 that reserves stopped dumping. So I wrote about that, and then I wrote other things in my book that I've done on the environmental area. That's where the water part comes in. And the two come together because I could see the kind of perseverance it took for my family to discover the iron ore. Others were looking, but it wasn't easy. They had to go to Tower on the railroad from Two Harbors and then walk over on some very tough trails to the area around Mountain Iron. And that's where they found the first mine. And then, of course, there were lots of other mines discovered. And all of this iron ore lay kind of horizontal rather than vertical like up at the Vermilion Range. So that's kind of a nutshell. And if you have another, do you have another edit or two?
Oh, you bet, Grant. I just want to reintroduce you to our listeners. We're speaking with Grant Merritt, a living legend in the Minnesota history of environmental protections. And Iron and Water is his new memoir chronicling his life on behalf of a 50-year-plus career as an attorney and an environmental activist who's done a lot of good over the years, Grant. And I think the biggest takeaway I took from your book was that you have the power to change the world. Individuals do wield the power to change the world. Talk about that a little bit.
Yes, well, it is it's very true many times around with the environmental issue, and certainly elsewhere. It takes the persistence that citizens have. And the government often doesn't do the job. We see that so often. For example, the whole dumping of Silver Bay never should have happened because the state issued a permit to reserve. And the permit said they could dump in the lake, but the tailings could not go out beyond 3 miles, the 9-square-mile zone off of Silver Bay. Well, it wasn't more than several years before the tailings were going way beyond that, and then pretty soon they went to Wisconsin, and they went to maybe even up towards Thunder Bay and over towards Michigan. And I can remember in the fall of some of those years in the 70s when the green water from Silver Bay would come down as far as Duluth. And they would meet the red water from the South Shore, you know, where there's a big rainstorms over there. The Nemadji River and others discolor the water, and that goes out. And so you had the red water from the South Shore meeting the green water from Silver Bay. It looked like Christmas out there.
How have things changed over the years in that regard? Is the government becoming more responsible, do you think, Grant?
Well, we've made progress, of course. Now we have permits. We have environmental impact statements. We never used to have that. And we do have liners on sanitary landfills, and we have covers over those landfills, at least some of them. And, you know, we're constantly trying to improve what's being done with wastewater discharges. But we still have ways to go. We still have too many lagoons around the state. These are called by the sanitary engineers wastewater stabilization basins, but they're really like lagoons, dirty lagoons, and they discharge in the spring and they turn anaerobic, which is too bad. There's a lot left to be done, but we have made a lot of progress, and we've had some real heroes. Bill Ruckel's house is one of them. And back when I was active in the PCA days 40 years ago, we had a fair amount of bipartisan support over the legislature. I can name at least a half a dozen Republicans from the House and Senate that were very interested in improving the environment. And we had a great conservative state senator from Little Falls, Senator Gordon Rosenmeyer. And he's the one that created the Pollution Control Agency in 1967. And he didn't like bureaucrats, so he made the policy making by a policy making board. So when I was they call it the executive director, I had to go to that board of citizens, nine citizens, and argue for what I thought should be done, and then the public could come in and testify. And of course, the media liked that, and that helped on the reserve mining case, just like the enforcement conference did. Unfortunately, we've lost the policy-making board now due to people that don't understand the importance of citizens being involved. And, of course, the enforcement conference law was done away with back in the early 80s after the reserve case. And that was unfortunate. So we got lots of things left to do.
Well, that's probably my last question for you, Grant, is what are you currently working on?
Well, I've been doing a couple of environmental cases. I've kept my law license to do some of that, but for almost 9 years, I worked hard on this book. And you know, what I had to do with stories that my father had told, oral history, I had to document, just like Bob Woodward is doing and did with his book, Fear. You know, an oral history is fine, but you really should try to find documentation for it. So here's an example. My father told me that my grandfather got revenge on Rockefeller by, after they'd lost everything, and even after they settled, he got the general manager of the Duluth Mesaba Northern Railroad, which my grandfather Milton was the president of, to go down and camp on Jim Hill, the great Northern Empire builder, you know, in St. Paul, and hire this Donald Philbin was his name, to work for Hill. My grandfather said, "You go down and camp on James J. Hill's doorstep." And so he did, and, well, that's a nice piece of oral history. So what I did was go over to the History Center there in St. Paul, and I'll be darned if I didn't find a documentary proof, a Ph.D., with letters footnoted and so forth, showing that Philbin was hired by James J. Hill, and he ended up running Hill's Railroad, which went up to the western part of the Mesaba Iron Range. That was an interesting piece of oral history that proved out.
Indeed. Now it is in writing as well. Iron and Wine, the new memoir from Grant Merritt, My Life Protecting Minnesota's Environment, and out on the University of Minnesota Press, widely available, very well received as well. Grant, congratulations on the new book. Well done.
Thank you. Thank you.
Congratulations on all your success over the year. Any parting words of wisdom for some folks listening that, you know, for ordinary citizens that will make a difference? What do you recommend?
Join groups like Save Lake Superior Association, write their legislators, get their politicians involved. That way you can get pressure on the polluters, and that's the best thing to do, in my opinion.
That's right. Step up. Well, Grant Merritt,
well, thank you.
Thank you, sir. Thank you very much. And good luck on all your future efforts.
Okay. See you sometime. Bye-bye.
Take care.